Hey everyone, it's Jonathan and welcome back to Every Version Ever. Today I'm joined by Nikki from Trivial Theater and we're talking about the 1924 silent film adaptation of Peter Pan, the very first version of the story ever created for the screen. This was the version I wanted to cover since I initially decided to do Peter Pan, but for some reason I thought this was just going to be a quick watch and we wouldn't have much to say. I figured this would be a really short episode. But little did I know, this one's actually a lot longer than most silent adaptations of the stories I've covered so far, and it covers parts of the book I hadn't seen adapted yet, and it actually has a pretty fascinating history. So, we actually had plenty to talk about. I was surprised by this movie. It was better than I thought it was going to be, and also longer than I thought it was going to be.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've done silent films before, and they've always been pretty short. This one was longer than some other versions of Peter Pan we've seen.
Yeah, it ran. The hour 40 runtime. I mean, I don't know. I guess movies of the 20s and even the teens, that, you know, there are those that stretch out, and it is a different experience because obviously you don't have the audio to kind of bring you along. But I didn't know what they were going to fill an hour 40 with. But they did it, and it went quickly. It was a well-put-together piece.
Yeah, they included more stuff than a lot of versions do, even though they omitted a lot of things that sometimes you would get in other versions. I was still surprised by how much was in this.
Yeah. Well, and there was even bits that, I guess we'll get to it later. But, there was stuff where it's like, oh, I didn't realize that that was a thing within Peter Pan. But, you know, if everything you've seen was, you know, like Disney movie or newer, It's understandable your interpretation of it would be different too. So
yeah, I had those moments multiple times because I finally finished reading this book while I was doing this version, because up until this point I'd only read like part of it. Like, it was funny because doing the 2003 version, towards the end of that I discovered, after having said that this was not in the book, that the Darlings adopt the Lost Boys.
Yes, that was, I would not have, I'm sure for the time they wanted, or maybe, you know, studio heads or whoever were like, hey, we need a happy ending.
Well, I just assumed that they had made that up for the 2003 version, because I hadn't finished the book.
Oh, it's real. Oh my gosh, I thought that was something that they just added.
No.
Oh!
That was the thing that I discovered while in the middle of recording the other podcast.
Because oh my gosh!
I was recording with Conrado and we were talking about that, and I said that was not in the book. And then we've talked about something else, moved on. I looked up something in the book later on, closer to the end. I was like, oh, wait a minute. That actually is in the book. Because I hadn't finished the book at that point. I finally finished it while I was making notes for this one.
Right. I didn't realize with this that it was a play before it had been made into a movie, which I, for the time it came out in like 1904 or 1905, I think. So a play would have been the place you would go, because movies at that point were still very, very new, or long form movies were still very, very new. But I always thought with most of this stuff, you assume it goes the other way.
Yeah. Well, Peter Pan has kind of the history kind of jumps around as to what it was, because it started out as a chapter in another book, and then he expanded that chapter into a book, and then into a play, and then I think he wrote a different ending for the play, but then he changed that ending into something for the book. I think he might have published that on its own as well, but the version that we have now is not how Peter Pan started out.
Oh.
It kind of jumped around before he finally got to the finished Peter Pan that we know today.
And I do have to, and this is, we were talking about this off air, but it struck me, like looking up the trivia on this, that J.M. Barrie was alive during this. Like, this came out in 1924 and he died in 37. And obviously today, you know, you've got like J.K. Rowling, you've got all kinds of authors that see their works brought to the screen. And I guess it's an age thing. The retrospective of thinking, oh my gosh, this guy that wrote this thing that is so culturally well known was there, and he picked out the person that played Peter. You know, he had worked on scripts and things like that for this. It's amazing.
Yeah, that surprised me too, because I hadn't, like, he's not listed as like a director or anything, but I started reading about the film. I was like, I got to Betty Bronson being picked as Peter Pan, and it said that J.M. Barrie himself had picked her out. I was like, wait, what? He helped make this thing?
Yeah.
I had not known that.
It's crazy. And oh my God. And also that this was, the movie itself was actually lost for a while. Because back in that point, like when prints went out to theaters, there wasn't one print that was kept as like a master. They would just send prints out to various places. And, you know, after that was done, for the most part, you know, those prints were tossed.
Yeah.
And that was located, where was it located?
Well, there were two copies found. There was
yes.
one, it said it was found at the Eastman School of Music in New York. And then the other one was at Disney, because Disney had gotten a copy when he'd acquired the rights to make this. Like, he acquired the rights all the way back in the 30s. Like, he didn't make it until the 50s.
Right.
But he was planning ahead. This is something he'd wanted to do. I think this is one of the ones that got delayed because of the war.
I wouldn't be surprised.
But he had gotten a copy of this back then, and it was still in their vault. So the version that, or the copy that Disney had, as well as the one from that school, were combined and restored to make the version that we have today.
Right. And it's a beautiful version. It's like, you know, you've even got some of the coloration that comes with a lot of silent movies. Not like full scene coloring to kind of show mood, but just like near the end when Hook attacks the Lost Boys, like the little mushroom is blue. I think that's really the only example of coloration in there. But no, it was yeah, it was cool to see. It was not that, I mean, a lot of stuff from the silent era is well preserved or, you know, maintained, but this, it was a very, very nice copy.
Yeah, I was surprised because I've done other versions, like versions of other stories, like most notably like Christmas Carol and Alice in Wonderland. And a lot of those, sometimes it's like almost impossible to tell exactly what you're seeing on screen because they're so degraded. But this one was like pristine almost. Like, it wasn't absolutely perfect, but it was the one of the most perfect old silent films that I've seen.
Oh yeah. It wasn't Star Wars Holiday Special level.
No, it was, the picture was even better than that kind of.
Oh wow, yeah. I do also have to add just real quick that, and I know why, like I think they were going in order of appearance, but I love that Nana gets top billing.
I wrote that too.
That, oh, that
cracked
tickled
me
me
up.
Something.
Nana gets top billing.
Yes. As you know what, if you have to play down on all fours and pretend to be a dog and everything else, you deserve top billing.
I had known going in that Nana and also the crocodile were played by humans, so I was expecting the worst. And then when it started, I was like, oh, this isn't half bad, actually. But then it did a close-up on her face.
Yeah, you know, it's not Ice Cream Bunny level bad, but it's thing.
The eyes.
Oh,
the
yeah.
eyes were haunting.
Oh, it was the same person that played. So Nana and the crocodile are both played by George Ali.
Yeah.
Also, and this is random and silly, but I love, so you know how they name, how names, how twins are named, like names that are very similar. So you might have like two very, you know, Betsy and Betty or whatever. They've got Winston and Weston. Are the twin Lost Boys.
Yeah.
That just, that I love that.
I should also mention too, this restored version had a score composed for it, because like back in the old silent days, that didn't usually happen.
No.
Like, a lot of times people would just play the piano along to the movie.
Yes.
It didn't always get like an actual score. But this one, when the full restoration was made in 94, Philip C. Carley composed a score for this. So we actually have music that was written for this movie.
That's cool. And it's a great movie to have it have a proper score for. You need
Yeah.
that.
Yeah. And you rarely get that for, like, even when they restore other silent films, they don't usually give them that. Because again, like, I've seen a bunch of other old silent films, and a lot of times they'll just put on some sort of generic music. Like old versions of A Christmas Carol have generic random Christmas music. And some of the worst ones are like when it sounds like it's directly from the 90s, like a little bit of a beat with the, that 90s sound to it. It's like this does not fit this at all.
No, not even remotely. This one is also it made the AAFI's top 100 heroes and villains. Captain Hook was a nominated villain, although I don't think he was put in there, which I'm sure he was quite upset about. It also had a 98% on Rotten Tomatoes based on 42 reviews. So, but I think so anything from that era, if it's not of decent quality, is going to rank pretty high just because of the respect of this thing survived to today.
Yeah,
So,
most of the
not that
ones
it's
that
not
have
wonderful.
survived are they survived for a reason, and not that any film that is lost was bad,
No.
but the ones that have survived are because people made an effort to preserve them. So they're probably good because somebody wanted them saved.
That or they're just scrappy ones that managed to avoid the fire heap or the garbage bin,
Yeah.
of which there are many in that respect too. It's also on Library of Congress and National Film Registry. So, which again makes sense for what it is, being that it was the first film adaptation of Peter Pan. So that in itself is significant.
Yeah, and done well. Like sometimes things that are the first version of something aren't that great, but this one was done well.
Absolutely. It seems like with that stuff, it's either they take the time and the care to really, really get the details correct. And especially if you've got the author of the book still alive, ideally speaking, and I think maybe a little more than now, there is that attention to detail paid. And sometimes that is to its detriment. It's like too many cooks in the kitchen,
I was
but
just thinking, like I said, a lot of things in this are parts that you don't usually see. Like the whole scene at the beginning with the medicine, like that is definitely from the book, but it does not really need to be included. I think the only reason that they kept it, at least in this version, is so that you could tie it back in towards the end when it's like an important plot point that children need to take their medicine. And so, they spent so much time with that in this, and I don't know that it was that necessary.
No, definitely not. But given everything, the important points of movies, and that, I mean, your main points are always going to be kind of consistent with movies. You focus on, the things that drive the plot. But some of that stuff, like you say, I think that it's movie making was a little bit more, not slow of a process, but there was a little bit more room for like other stuff. So.
I also wonder if it's something like if they were trying to go for a longer movie, but there is a lot of stuff in the book that would have been next to impossible to do at the time.
Right.
Like they completely cut out the scene of them actually flying to Neverland. They didn't even do a montage. Like a lot of versions will just do a montage and not even include the conversations, but they
Right.
didn't do that at all. And they didn't do it like the scenes from the book with the mermaids. They made up a new scene, which was weird, but anything that would have taken a lot of special effects, they didn't do. So I'm wondering if they kept the medicine scene that long just to fill time.
Possibly. They did have at the very like as soon as they started flying, they did have them like model of the city and then flying over the city. Although, so that's one thing I do have a question about, and I know that the original story takes place in London, and I assumed that every version of this basically took place in London.
Yes.
What was going on with all of the US talk? And the only thing I can think is that post World War I, there might have been something about like, hey, we're playing to a largely American audience, let's do the American thing, or I had no idea what was going on. But multiple times, like, hey kid, you want to be a pirate? Yeah, as long as I can be for the stars and stripes.
That cracked me up so much. Those lines, I was initially confused. I was like, what on earth are they doing? So I looked up those specific passages in the book. They're not taken word for word from the book, but they are taken from the book. But any reference to England or Britain was replaced with an American reference. So
I'm not
those lines are sort of in the book, but I guess they're, like I said, there are things in this that are like almost too close to the book. Like they really tried to go for an adaptation of everything as much as they could. So I'm wondering if they just did that and were like, well, we're not in England, we're in America. We got to make this American. I don't know.
I could see that, and that was kind of my thinking, was just the fact that, it's an American distribution company, it's made in the States. That's all I could think. So
Yeah, I think this is the only version I've seen so far that has them as American children. Like up until they actually said that, like the one kid in the when they're in the underground hideout at one point, one kid says something about being a an American or let's
an
see.
American, you must behave around ladies like an American gentleman.
Yes. And that was the first scene where I was like, raise my eyebrow, like, what? What's going on here? And then later on, when they like fully break out into singing "My Country, 'Tis of Thee," and then I was like, okay, I need to look this stuff up in the book and see what's going on here. There was not a scene where they all sing a song in the book, though. That the scene singing "My Country, 'Tis of Thee" was definitely added to this version.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, the beginning of this, a lot of it is from the book more so than other versions, including the fact that, like, it's not exactly the same, but Mrs. Darling sees Peter Pan at the beginning, and she's the one to put his shadow in the drawer after it gets caught in the window, which I think usually they have Wendy be the one to find his shadow.
Oh.
And it's in the book, Mrs. Darling is the one who puts the shadow in the drawer. So that was another thing that I was kind of surprised they actually did for this version.
That is interesting. There was definitely, and my experiences with Peter Pan generally, like it started with the Disney movie. It was anything in the 90s. Obviously, we did Hook, and some of the more recent adaptations that have come out I've seen. But yeah, anything pre that, they all kind of follow the same thing where it's you see a little bit of Mr. and Mrs. Darling, but they are very auxiliary characters.
Yeah. And you don't always get Mr. and Mrs. Darling seeing the children leave.
Right.
Like, that is also from the book. And they are gone for a very long time to the point where they're like despairing. Like, by the end of the book, Mr. Darling is living in the doghouse, depressed, like, literally living in the doghouse because he blames himself for what he did with Nana. But you don't always get that. Usually, you have them leave. Like with the Disney version, they leave for a party, and by the time they get back, the kids are back. I guess they're kind of going with like Narnia rules for time. But like in the book and this version, they're gone a long time.
It seemed like it, just the way that the reactions were going and such, and Mrs. Darling's reaction of, I keep hearing my kids, and oh, there they are, but they're clearly not here, and then they put their she puts her arms around them, and they're like, ah, you're here.
I was also really impressed with Tinkerbell. Like, I was
Oh.
expecting her to be like just somebody shining a light around, like a laser pointer. But they actually did a good job with the special effects for her.
They did very much, and that was, I think I read it was the first time that Tinkerbell was portrayed by something other than a spotlight.
Probably because, like, I'd always read about how she was portrayed on, like, the stage, and I think I was probably just assuming that that's what they were going to do here because I didn't really think about, like, obviously they did do similar effects for other things at the time, but since I had read so much about how they did it on the stage, I just assumed that that's what they'd go with. But they actually went with the extra effort of making her an actual character. One of my favorite parts at the beginning was when Peter's trying to convince Wendy to come to Neverland and she's hesitating because of her brothers, and he goes over and just kicks John out of bed.
They weren't screwing around. You get up or you're gonna you yeah.
Then when they go to Neverland, another thing that just made me laugh was, like I said, they skipped all of the scenes with them flying, and then you just kind of have sort of a montage of scenes on Neverland, like establishing shots. There's like a pack of wolves who are just humans in weird Nana suits. And also a lion who is immediately killed by Tiger Lily's tribe, and the way that it falls over and dies. I just burst out laughing. You also have a scene before the kids get to Neverland with the pirates that they've added in. This wasn't in the book, where the pirates feed the clock to the crocodile. I think in the book it's sort of explained as more of like an accident, like the crocodile ate a clock and they were happy that they now have a way to figure out where it is so they can avoid him. But in this version, it has Hook feeding it to him on purpose so that they will always be warned that he's coming.
Right.
And then they spent a lot longer than I expected again on the scene where where Tinkerbell tries to murder Wendy using the lost voice. Like a lot of times they'll kind of go through that pretty quickly, but they actually have her quote unquote dead for longer than you would expect with Peter mourning over her body. And then I was initially confused, like the scene where they build the house around her. In the movie, it's like the house is building itself. So I was like, I don't remember that in the book at all. So I went back and reread the passage, and it's not, I feel like some of the book is written in such a way that you have to like really concentrate as to what you're reading.
Right.
And I think that they're describing it as the Lost Boys are bringing the materials, but they're also imagining and pretending to build the house. And then
Oh.
there's like a line about things in reality and things that are pretending being one and the same. So I think that's what they were going for with the house building itself.
Right. And that would make sense given not that it was terribly close to it, but with like a Hook where they're eating the food but the food isn't real.
I thought that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there was another line later in the book, I didn't write it down, but there was something about when it was talking about pretending and reality being the same, and there was a line about them having trouble with that when it came to pretending that they'd already eaten or something like that. Like some of the lines, I feel like this is one of those books that I would benefit from somebody doing a more modern translation. I think mine is written, not like it's old English or anything, but
Right.
it's not perfectly clear as to what they're saying without you like really focusing on what you're reading.
Right. No, and that's fair. And I mean, what words mean and stuff has certainly changed over the years too. So, your interpretation of something with a 2020 odd perspective or 2020-ish perspective versus someone that was reading it in, 1905 is going to have a completely different experience.
We ran into that, or we talked about this in our episode on the 2003 version. Like, there's a line, and it's actually in this version too, because it's not in this version, but in the book, Peter, after he leaves, he comes back and takes Wendy's daughter after Wendy has grown up. And then he leaves and comes back and takes Wendy's granddaughter. And it keeps going like that. And then the last line of the book, it says, when Margaret grows up, she will have a daughter who is to be Peter's mother in turn. And so it will go on as so long as children are gay and innocent and heartless. And we were like, heartless must have changed meanings.
Well, and I think what they, because I looked up a little bit on the history of Peter Pan, like what the interpretation of it was, and they defined Peter as with a kid, you're kind of selfish, I guess, because it is about your fun. It's about your times. You don't really, there isn't a lot of necessarily thought given to a lot of other stuff.
That makes sense, actually. So in that way, it hasn't exactly changed the meanings.
Well, it's
They
like,
it's not like they mean like children are awful, but like
right.
he is in a way heartless.
Right, children's first priority is themselves. Like he's so fascinated, there's the line about death would be an incredible adventure, is one of the lines that they referenced.
Yeah.
And they're talking about how Peter wasn't really focused on the fact that, and I think it was when Wendy was, quote, killed by Tinkerbell, but I think that's when it was referenced. But basically it was like, he was more interested in the perspective of, ooh, look. Here's a thing I haven't seen before versus, oh my gosh, this person that I brought here is, been killed by one of my people. Ah,
Yeah, I don't remember where that line was used in this version. In the book, it's used in a scene that they omitted for this version. Because in the book, Tiger Lily is captured by the pirates, And this is the scene that they usually put in versions, so I was kind of weird to have it not be in this one. But Tiger Lily is captured and Peter is injured in the fight. And I think they're like on a rock or something, and the tide is coming in, and they're both of them are unable to fly. He's with Wendy and they're alone. And I think one of the Lost Boys flies a kite out to them, and Peter ties Wendy to the kite so that she can fly away and escape. And he thinks he's going to die, and he says to die will be an awfully big adventure.
Oh, okay. That would make sense.
But yeah, that scene is not in this movie. That was just one
Right.
of the ones that
No,
they
no.
omitted.
I would imagine too that would be, I mean, even given the effects of this era, you're still talking a movie that probably didn't have a massive budget. Even if they were able to do the effects at that point, trying to, do that kind of a thing, that would take quite a lot, I would think.
Yeah, they used the flying pretty sparingly. I think the way they did it worked well. I thought it was kind of impressive how well they were able to do it. It wasn't perfect, but it was better than I expected it to be.
When they go to jump out the window and go take off into flight, the little kid, John, is John the little one or is it Michael?
Michael's the youngest.
Michael. When he goes out the window and he takes off to flight, I just imagine them outfitting that poor little actor in whatever harness they were going to use to have them fly. Like, okay, kiddo, get ready to fly. He's like, ah. Also, when Mr. and Mrs. Darling come back to the house and you see them all like flying in a circle, it's like they were all attached to a ceiling fan, just like going really quickly.
Yeah, like I said, there's a big chunk of the middle of the book that they did not include, which I think is most of the stuff that they would have had a really hard time adapting. But because of that, they don't have the scene where Peter saves Tiger Lily. So I think basically just the tribe and the Lost Boys are all just friends in this version. Like they're in the book, that's more of like semi-antagonistic relationship at the beginning until Peter saves Tiger Lily,
Makes sense.
which it's probably fine because I was kind of like, this movie is, again, it's not perfect, but there was a lot less like overt racism than I was expecting, because there is kind of a lot in the book. Like it's kind of cringy in places.
There was a line about the losing to the Redskins. All I could think was the Washington Redskins? How did people lose to them? They're a terrible team.
I think, well, they're called that in the book too, but like the worst thing, I believe it's called like the Pickaninny Tribe, which
Oh,
doesn't
yeah.
even make sense because I thought that that was like a slur for
It
like
is.
slaves. So it seems weird to have it be for this tribe, but like I'm not up on all of my slurs, so I
You know,
don't know for sure.
that's not the worst thing in the world by any stretch. I found it really interesting, and most time in those cases in regard to, that's probably more down the road a bit as far as like the history of Hollywood. But the fact that they had a Chinese actress, Chinese American actress play Tiger Lily was really interesting. Like, because most of the time they would just do like, whatever, brown face or whatever on, just a white actress and call it a day. But it was actually a really well-known, or became well-known actress by the name of Anna May Wong, really well-known back in early Hollywood. So.
Yeah, I'd never heard of her, but I thought that was interesting because I did look to see who had played her.
It's like, hey, we're gonna get you a role. Oh, yay! You're gonna be playing a Native American. What? But I mean, that was a kind of a thing, and even, black and white aside, you'd have Italians doubling for Latinos or whatever it might be. I mean,
It's like, we
I
need a
don't know.
non-white person. There's one.
You'll do.
The wrong kind. Oh, nobody will notice. Not that it doesn't happen nowadays, but thankfully it happens a lot less.
Yeah.
So you have the scene with Wendy telling the boys a bedtime story and inviting the Lost Boys to come home with them. And that's where you get the first line about behaving like an American gentleman. And they're being guarded by Tiger Lily's tribe, like they're all outside. And Wendy is trying to get Peter to come home with them, but he refuses. Like they skipped over so much. Like they basically arrive at Neverland. Wendy is shot down. They build a house around her. Then they go down underground. She tells them a story, and then they decide to go home. There's so much more in the book that happens, but they skip over all that. But anyways, this is where Wendy tells him that even if he doesn't come home with it, he needs to remember to take his medicine, because that was a thing in the book. For whatever reason, kids need to know to take their medicine.
Absolutely. It is quite important.
So she leaves him some medicine and they're preparing to leave, but then you hear the battle start outside, and it's not very clear either in this version or the book exactly what happens. The book basically just says that there was a massacre and they want to get this over with quickly. And it doesn't explain what happened to Tiger Lily either. Like, there's a line in the book about her cutting her way through several pirates, but I'm not sure that she's mentioned again after that. And it's kind of heavily implied that almost her entire tribe was wiped out. So I don't know if that includes her or not.
Ooh, that's not good.
Yeah. And then, of course, everybody's captured except for Peter Pan, because he didn't want to leave with them. And Captain Hook goes in to kill him, but he can't really fit through the door, which, like, I know it's from the book and they had to do it like that because they're trying to be from the book. But the way that that door was shaped, I feel like he could have just kind of gone over it. Oh, well. Since he can't get through the door, he decides since he can reach Peter's medicine, he's going to poison him instead.
Gasp.
And then you've got Tinkerbell trying to warn him, but he won't listen. So she drinks it so that he won't be able to drink it himself. In the book, he's going to drink it, and she like jumps between the cup and his lips and drinks it as he's pouring it. In this one, he's not even there. It doesn't look like he's trying to drink it at all. She just drinks it so that he can't get to it later.
Right.
And then you've got the famous fourth wall breaking scene, which I feel works
Yes.
best in the play, but I think they do a good job with it in this version. I actually think that they do a better job in this version than the book. Like in the book, and like in the 2003 version, it's almost like Peter is telepathically communicating with all the children of the world.
You never know, he might be.
Like the line is something about all the children who are dreaming of Neverland. He's like calling out to them, like trying to get them to clap. But like I feel like it works so much better for the play, and that in this version, when Peter like is addressing the audience, trying to get them to believe in fairies so that Tinkerbell can be saved. I should look it up though. There was a line in the book about Tinkerbell sitting up and listening for the children to see what her fate would be. It cracked me up. Oh, here it is. "Do you believe?" he cried. Tink sat up in bed almost briskly to listen to her fate. She fancied she heard answers in the affirmative, and then again she wasn't sure. "What do you think?" she asked Peter. "If you believe," he shouted to them, "clap your hands. Don't let Tink die." Many clapped. Some didn't. A few little beasts hissed. The clapping stopped suddenly, as if countless mothers had rushed to their nurseries to see what on earth was happening. But already Tink was saved. First her voice grew strong, then she popped out of bed, and she was flashing through the room more merry and impudent than ever. She never thought of thanking those who believed, but she would have liked to go and get the who had hissed. I love Tinkerbell. She's
Yeah.
kind of terrible, but I love her.
Yeah, she's very much of her own mind, there's no doubt. I will say, with the audience participation thing, that's the first time I'm and regarded, obviously if you're talking stage plays, that's probably a normal thing for that kind of a fourth wall break. And I've not seen obviously every movie that came out before 1924. But this has to be one of those first times when they really tried to get audience participation.
I was wondering that, yeah.
But on the other side, I suppose, being that there was so many things that were adapted from the stage to the screen, maybe it was more of a common thing. Because I'm sure that audience participation was a thing that went on, especially for kids' media.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't really seen anything where a character like turns around and addresses the viewers, especially not, well, not from that era anyway.
Right.
Well, after Tinkerbell is saved, Peter goes to rescue the darlings and the lost boys. But they've added a scene in here where he goes to find the mermaid queen who can help him find the crocodile, and that is not in the book.
They spent a lot of time with the mermaids.
They spent more time than I expected, and that's the time that they spent with them was never something that was in the book. Like, there are scenes with the mermaids in the book, but I feel like they're all too complicated to film, at least at the time. Like, I think there's the scene where I don't remember exactly how it was described, but in my mind, the way they were playing a game with like bubbles, and in my mind, it was like water polo or soccer or something.
Oh.
Like, there was a line about John having an idea to hit the ball with his head. And then from that day on, the mermaids always played it that way. And that was the way John left his mark on Neverland. Something like that.
Interesting. Well, that's a good way to do it.
But yeah, this scene with him finding the mermaid queen to find the crocodile, not in the book. And I feel like it didn't need to be in this version either, because the way that they do this in the book makes so much more sense than the way they do it here, because he wants to find the crocodile so that he can get the clock back from it and use it to trick Captain Hook. But in the book, he just passes the crocodile on his way to the pirates and notices that it's no longer ticking. And he thinks the clock must have finally wound down after all this time. So he decides to mimic the ticking sound, but he's not even doing it to trick the pirates. He's doing it so that any animals on his way to the pirates will hear it and think he's the crocodile and leave him alone. And then by the time he gets to the pirate ship, he's still doing it. So then the pirates think it's the crocodile. I feel like that makes so much more sense than, oh, I gotta go find the mermaid queen so that she can help me find the crocodile so that I can get the clock out of its stomach.
It's like a scene from Goodfellas. At one point, Ray Liotta's got to go to like this guy to drop off this stuff to go take that stuff to this guy, and he's got to make sure to check on the pasta, and then he's got to go over here. Like the whole day is just like one thing is contingent on another, on another, on another, and yeah. But can I just say, and I know that Peter Pan is kind of silly, but Peter Pan is kind of silly.
Yeah.
And I say that with love because, oh my God, I was sitting there and it's like, I never really thought about like the fact that, oh, you know, they put a clock inside of a crocodile. That way you knew it was coming. Like, how often do you run across a crocodile where there's a chance he's gonna, you know, try and eat your other hand?
Well, it's explained in the book, and I think they might even have a line similar in this movie where the crocodile got a taste for him and now he wants to eat the rest of him because he was so delicious. And Smee tells him that it's sort of a compliment. Which Hook does not want to hear.
There are a lot of cute little moments like that. And obviously, you know, with this one, they weren't probably going too far off the source material as far as what was said. Obviously, as you said, they kind of added and took away certain scenes, but I don't know. Like just some of the verbiage is so cute. Like genuinely, it's adorable.
Yeah. But then we get to the ship where Captain Hook is trying to convince the Darlings and Lost Boys to join him. And then this is the other hilarious attempt at turning it into an American story where he says he wants to be a pirate, but can we still be faithful to the Stars and Stripes? No, then I refuse. And I refuse too.
Then they really get the pirate's goat by starting to sing My Country Tis of Thee.
Yes. Which is similar to the book, but like in the book, there's a longer scene of John kind of waffling back and forth of whether he wants to join the pirates or not, and Michael thinking that he'll do whatever John does. And then he finally asks if they would still be respectful subjects of the king. And Captain Hook says, tells him that he must swear down with the king. And he refuses. And
Oh
one of the Lost Boys shouts, "Rule Britannia!" Which I thought was kind of weird and hilarious because it's firmly established that the Lost Boys are babies who fell out of their perambulators and grew up in Neverland. They should have no idea what England even is.
That just goes to show you how deep the love of country goes in these boys.
Apparently.
Yes.
But then you have them going to get Wendy, and she tells the Lost Boys that she has a message from their real mothers, and she hopes that they die like American gentlemen, which is kind of hilariously morbid. But that actually came from the book too, except that she says English gentlemen,
Right.
and that and instead of starting to sing My Country 'Tis of Thee in the book, they're basically just roused into fighting and it impresses the pirates. So it's technically true to the book, even though they put their own American spin on it.
Right. The part where it's another one of those things that just kind of like, and I'm sure that it's probably in the book too, but when Mr. Smee goes over to Wendy and he's like, I'll set you free if you'll be my mother. And she goes,
yeah, that's in the book. Yes.
Is that why there's so many pirates? Because they don't have mothers? I feel bad for them.
No, I think one of the things in the book was the pirates are considering making her their mother. And then you have the scene from the book where Smee goes over to her when she's tied to the mast and says he'll set her free if she agrees to be his mother. And she refuses.
Out of curiosity, how much difference is there supposed to be in age between Wendy, Michael, and John?
I'm not sure.
Like, is she like 12, 13, probably?
I've always thought of her as like somewhere between 10 and 12, but I'm not sure if it actually says that.
Because one of the trivia pieces was there were only 3 years between Mrs. Darling and her, like the actresses, which would make sense for the time. Like, that's kind of how they rolled, but.
I didn't think about it, but I did think that the actress who played Wendy seemed a bit old.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the one from Peter, like the Disney Peter Pan, and you definitely get younger girl, so.
Mm-hmm. Their ages are not explicitly stated in the book. Wendy is typically portrayed as around 12 years old, while John and Michael are younger, likely around 8 and 5.
Okay, that would make, like, the boys made sense. I just was never sure of Wendy, and the way that girls look as they age, you know, it can be a little hard to tell. But yeah, the actress portraying Wendy in this was definitely a little older than was probably meant to be portrayed. But again, that's not outside the box in a lot of cases.
Yeah. In my head, Wendy has always been somewhere between like 10, 14 at the very oldest, but kind of around 12.
Right.
And John is like between 8 and 10, and Michael's like 4 to 6. But it's apparently it's never said in the book. And I didn't remember reading that, but that confirms it. And then you have Peter arriving at the ship and actually killing off the pirates one by one, which is actually in the book. Like stabbing somebody in the dark, and then somebody comes out and says, so-and-so's dead. And then they go in and they get stabbed.
I will say, I thought that was well handled. And obviously, you know, if you look at like Looney Tunes out of that era, they weren't afraid to show a lot of stuff, but they handled like live action death well, I thought, you know, kind of keeping it in silhouette. And obviously it's in the dark, but you know, that's still hard to portray, or can be.
And then you've got the big battle. And I love the scene where Michael kills a pirate. at least he thinks he kills a pirate. He's like standing over the body and yelling to Wendy that he's killed one. And she's like, that's awful. But then the pirate gets up and runs away and Michael chases him. But in the book, I think he actually did kill one. So.
Oh, wow. Well, you know what? If you're going to kill, I guess start at an early age.
Got to get some early experience.
You do. You know, experience is key. They're never going to take you seriously if you don't, especially if you're going to be a pirate.
And then you get a scene that's not usually adapted, at least not in ones that I've seen so far, where Peter actually stabs Captain Hook and he declares himself to be joy and youth and a little bird that has broken out of the egg. That's actually from the book.
Oh, wow. And I think that's, I read something where like the way that Peter's described in the chapter, like the book is called Little Bird or White Little Bird or something like that. Like that's kind of where the notion of the bird thing came from, was that the initial book that he was featured in.
It might have, like, I think you're right. There's like a little white bird, but I don't remember if that was that might have been the name of the book where the chapter was taken from. Yeah, The Little White Bird. It was a book for adults, but there was a chapter in there about Peter Pan, which then he turned into the play and the book and everything else.
I did find it interesting the way that, and I know this is more of a comment on Peter Pan generally, not so much, I guess, this one in particular, but like they talk about the amazing magical boy that, you know, shows everybody the wonders of being a kid, but yet, you know, the kind of struggle within him to be, you know, kind of that joyful, carefree kiddo, you know, and not show tears and all the rest.
He's kind of a complicated character.
Yeah, oh, very much.
In the book, too, there's a line about like Mrs. Darling is remembering a story that she heard about Peter Pan being the person who guides children to heaven when they die. Like, if a child
Oh.
dies, Peter Pan
Oh,
is the one who
wow.
takes them like halfway there
Oh.
so they won't be scared.
Right. Wow. That's beautiful and very dark.
Yeah.
Well, even like J.M. Barrie, like the idea of Peter Pan was based off of his brother who died at, I think, 14.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact age, but he did get the idea after his brother's death.
Yeah.
Like he like fell through the ice or something.
I
Like
think
there was a
so.
skating accident, I think.
Yeah, that it's amazing. Like those, the way that we immortalize those that we love.
Yeah. But yeah, back to the scene that's not usually in any version. After Hook gets stabbed, he runs below ship and is gonna like blow the thing up. Like, and when that happened, I was like, they had to have added this to this version. I know it's in the book. And Peter runs down and grabs the powder keg and tosses it in the ocean before it explodes. In this version, you have Captain Hook walking the plank. But in the book, I think he just kind of purposely jumps in the water to get away from Peter. Because I think it said something about Peter flying towards him with his knife, or he was going to kick him. And then he just jumped overboard. And then it's explained that the crocodile, who was no longer ticking, was waiting below for him. And then there's a scene in the movie later after the kids win where you see the crocodile like cough up a shoe. So it's basically implied that he got it eaten either way.
Rest in peace.
Rest in pieces.
Yes.
And then in the book, not in the movie, there was a line about all the pirates dying except for two of them. It said that Starkey made it to shore, but he was captured by the remaining Indians and forced to be the nursemaid to their papooses,
Aww.
which is described as a melancholy come down for a pirate.
You know, Melancholy Come Down sounds like a great punk band.
Was thinking it sounded like one of those quiet big band things. Melancholy come down.
Oh my gosh, you're right. It totally does.
Was something that would play on Lawrence Welk.
Right, we're going to play Melancholy Come Down, the one and the two and the...
Then the other pirate that survived was Smee, who afterwards made a living traveling the world telling stories of his time as the only pirate that Captain Hook feared. And then the kids sail home in the pirate ship. And then you get a scene where Peter goes ahead of the darlings to try and lock the window so they can't get in. And they'll think that their parents don't want them anymore and they'll go back with him to Neverland. And that's actually from the book. That's like, it's not a scene that you're very familiar with usually. Like, if you're thinking of the Disney version, like that's not usually how it goes, but it is in the book. He doesn't want Wendy to go back, so he tries to trick her into thinking her parents don't want her. But then he sees how sad Mrs. Darling is and decides he's not actually going to do that.
Aw, at his heart of hearts, he's a good people.
And then you have a scene where, like, at the time that we watched Hook, I had not finished the book. But this scene, I think, was adapted to the end of Hook, where the kids get home and then go and get into bed so that, like, it would be like they never left. Because remember that happened in Hook, and I was talking about, like, why did they do that? I think they were adapting that scene from the book for the end of Hook.
Very possibly. In grand scheme, it would make sense.
And then you get the scene with the Lost Boys revealing themselves and being adopted by the Darlings.
And they're all still decked out in pirate acquire or pirate attire.
Yes. And most of this, like this, with the Lost Boys and stuff, like the original story, because like I said, there was like, I don't know how many different versions before we got to where we are now. It didn't initially end with them being adopted. I think it ended before the final chapter, because the final chapter called When Wendy Grew Up, I think that that final chapter is what he added. And the way it initially ended was like almost depressing, because like they get home and they're reunited with their parents, and Peter is watching through the window, and it's described as he's looking through the window at the one joy from which he must be forever barred. But then in the chapter that he added, that's when you get the revelation that the other boys came with them and they get adopted. And then you get the scene with Wendy and her mother trying to convince Peter to be adopted as well. And he refuses. And then that's where they end the movie. But then, like I said, in the book, he actually does go back. I think he at least one time he brings her back for the spring cleaning. And then after that, she doesn't see him again until she's an adult. And then he takes her daughter and then her granddaughter. And then that's the line about it will keep happening that way as long as children are gay and innocent and heartless.
Man, it's such an interesting story.
Yeah. It's a lot more interesting than you would get just watching the Disney version.
Oh, yeah.
That's how it is with most movies, not just Disney, but like when you read the book, there's so much more to it. And it's always interesting to see what different versions choose to include in their adaptations and what they leave out.
Agreed.
Anyways, I suppose that will be all for this episode.
Do we need to clap to bring Tink back to life?
Well, you say that, but by the end of the book, she was dead. She actually died by the end of the book.
Because
there was a line where when Peter Pan came back to get Wendy for the summer trip, that by that point, Tinkerbell had already died because fairies don't live very long.
Oh,
and he had forgotten about her.
Oh my God.
That was another thing. I guess we're not done. Back in, this movie omitted like a huge key part of the book. Like they made slight references to it, but in the book, one of the prominent themes is that Peter Pan and the Lost Boys and the Darlings too, they forget their lives. Like by the time, like Wendy's the only one who is mostly not affected. She's the one who's noticing this happen.
Mm-hmm.
Her brothers forget their parents.
Oh yeah. Michael mentions it when they get back. He's like, who's that lady?
Yeah. That was one of the things, like, because they cut out the middle of the movie or the middle of the book for this movie, that was kind of happening the way through. They come to think of Wendy and Peter as their parents. And Wendy is kind of disturbed by this. And she's like, we need to get back home before they like actually forget about our parents.
Right. Well, and that's always like, I'm sorry, but Peter Pan as a dad would be a terrible idea.
Yeah. I don't think it's in the book, but in the 2003 version, one of my favorite things was when he's trying to be the kid's parents. He's talking about, like, I think he said something about, first he says they like they need a spanking, and then he's just going to straight up kill them all.
I mean, it's a very definitive way to be a father, I guess, but I'm not sure that's maybe the best way to go about it. How do you go from spanking to killing?
He's a little terror.
Well, it goes to show heartless, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, early 20th century writing. Oh, my goodness.
Anyways, all that to say, Peter Pan forgot who Tinkerbell was by the time that he got back to Wendy. Because I think it's explained by the narrator, not by Peter, that she had died in the previous year between Wendy going back home and then Peter Pan coming back for her. And Peter had forgotten about her.
That's like the kid that can't keep a turtle alive or something. It's like, oh, it went, you know, it went up north to a farm. Tinkerbell went to a farm up north.
Well, on that note.
Yeah, exactly.
Tinkerbell's done. I think we are too.
Yeah, probably right on.
Well, I think that will probably be all for at least you and I on Peter Pan. We might do another one in the future because there's more Peter Pan. I will probably come back to the story at some point, but you'll be back next month to talk Wind in the Willows.
Absolutely.
But in the meantime, do you want to let people know where they can find you if they want more from you?
You can check me out here on YouTube at Trivial Theater. I do a wide array of random, obscure, and straight up edit movies, so definitely stop by and say hello.
Okay, we will see you next month.
We shall see you then.
Thanks for listening to Every Version Ever. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe and follow my co-hosts as well. My link tree and all of our links will be in the description below. If you want more of my content, all my podcasts are available on YouTube as well as most podcast platforms. If you enjoyed this show, check out one of the other podcasts or check out my Patreon for bonus and extended episodes you won't find anywhere else. We'll be back soon with another brand new episode, so thanks for listening and we'll see you next time.